trigger warning. This podcast is intended for men, not boys, not babies, men.
This is how we disable toxic masculinity.
We need to kill all men.
This pagan patriarchalism that is coming back out of the shadows.
Feminists hate patriarchy.
It's the woman that runs the show and the woman that runs the community and is the backbone of their area.
I'm a nasty woman. A loud, vulgar, proud woman.
Patriarchy.
You are male privilege.
Are you saying you have authority over me? Go eat your superior.
I personally can't see why egalitarianism would be a bad thing.
The assumption that wives should make babies instead of money is part of the patriarchy.
Don't f***ing say hi to strange women you don't know.
Patriarchy.
The patriarchy.
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 Strong, and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in His sight. And that is 2 Samuel chapter 10, verse 12. You are on the Fight, Laugh, Feast Network, and you are listening to The Patriarchy. My name is Tony DePonte, and I am joined by my co-host, Pastor Joseph Randall Spurgeon.
Woman, get back in here and make me a sandwich.
Joseph, what kind of sandwich are you eating today?
Well, here's the thing, man. I'm trying to get me a sandwich, and I'm in the middle of fixing one. Kids are running around, making all kinds of noise. We're trying to record, and it sounds like an explosion going on there. Like some of the kids are playing like a trumpet or something, and Tony, didn't you ask me? You said it sounds like an elephant in there. What are you guys doing? And thing is, we can't really talk about it.
Okay. Why?
Because we're not talking about the elephant in the room.
I walked right into that. Why didn't I see that one coming? I just lobbed that one up like a softball. And so do you even have a sandwich?
No, because the elephant stopped me from eating it.
Yep. Yeah, sure. Okay. Nice excuse. Okay. Well, my sandwich isn't super interesting, but it's just a ham sandwich, Swiss cheese. It's got some mustard on it and on wheat bread, but it's good. I mean, ham and Swiss cheese and mustard has a kind of a good zesty taste to it. But yeah, it's not super exciting, I mean, you know, but it's a good sandwich. It's a good sandwich.
Hey, it takes your wife a lot of work. She had to slaughter the pig. She had to butcher it, cook the ham, just get it just right. You probably had to smoke it. And I don't know how she made the mustard. You're going to have to tell me about that.
I'll have to ask her. I'm sure it had to do with, she probably harvested, you know, the mustard seeds and ground them up. And one of those, I don't know. All the wives are probably saying what I'm trying to think of right now, the little mortar thing, and a little dish with the you grind up stuff in it. I don't know.
Pestle and mortar?
Yeah, there you go, that one. And see, I said all the wives would know, and you knew. You grind all that, and you make your mustard with it, and something like that. I don't know. I have no idea how you make mustard. I just know it has mustard seeds.
Well, if you have faith.
Oh, man. You are just full of dad jokes tonight, aren't you? The Christian dad jokes, I guess, at that point.
That's a Christian. That's ChristianDadJokes.com. That's my new website.
Oh, no. Oh, boy. Yeah.
There. I usually what I do is I just copy the regular dad jokes. I just wait about 3 or 4 years and make them not as good.
That's a low blow. It's true, but that's a low blow. Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah, right? That is... Wow, yeah, that is very true. All right, enough of that, though. On to our next segment.
Hey,
Oh, that's heresy, Patrick.
Hey, this is Father Andre again, and we're talking this week about parables. What these parables mean to us and what Jesus is trying to get us to understand about God's love through these parables. Yesterday, we talked about the sower and the seed and the abundance of Christ's love and grace for us. Today, I want to talk about one of my favorites, the parable of the Good Shepherd. You grew up knowing about the Good Shepherd, right? The Good Shepherd will leave 99 to go after the one. And what I've always found interesting about this is that it shows that God is a risk taker.
No.
That's heresy, Patrick.
Yeah, that's heresy, Patrick. No, I could tell.
So why is that? Why is it heresy?
Why is it heresy? Because God, yeah, God can't take risks.
Well, what's necessary for a risk to take place?
Failure. That'd be one of them.
Yeah, there's the possibility of failure.
Mm-hmm.
There's the unknown.
Right.
And it requires faith. And are those characteristics that our God has?
No.
Not knowing the future and has a possibility of failure?
No, not at all.
No.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. There's another a book that it's got a couple little helpful things. I can remember reading it years ago called Wild at Heart. Oh, you ever heard of that?
Yeah. You're right. There's some helpful things.
John Eldridge's name. It was it was a book about trying to just recapture manliness.
Right.
Obviously, as we're going to see here, it went off the rails. And this is one of the things he says. He says, in an attempt to secure the sovereignty of God, theologians have overstated their case and left us with a chess player, God playing both sides of the board, making all his moves and all of ours too. But clearly this is not so. God is a person who takes immense risks. No doubt the biggest risk of all was when he gave angels and men free will, including the freedom to reject him, not just once, but every single day. There is something much more risky here than we're often willing to admit.
Oh, ouch. Yeah, you know, I haven't read that in a really long time, so there's probably going to be some things we're going to quote in here that I don't even remember in that book. But, yeah,
he goes on to say, God did not make Adam and Eve obey him. He took a risk. A staggering risk with staggering consequences. He let others into his story, and he let their choices shape it profoundly.
Sheesh.
And so God's willingness to risk is just astounding, far beyond what any of us would be willing to do if we were in his position.
I can't remember. At any point, maybe still is, I don't know. Is John Elder still, he's still alive, isn't he?
I think so.
Yeah, is he an open theist? Because he certainly sounds like one.
Yeah. I mean, the only way God can risk is if God doesn't know the outcome of his actions. And furthermore, if God can fail. And if God can fail, we're up a creek without a paddle.
Yeah, we're up a specific kind of creek without a paddle, too. Yeah.
Right? Because that means the promises of God's word, I'll be with you to the end of the age. The book of Revelation declaring Jesus as king, that Satan's defeated. You know, God's promises for us might be just a
wishful thinking.
Risk. It might be a calculated risk.
Yeah.
You know, Isaiah 46:9-10 puts it to bed. It says, remember the former things long past, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is no one like me, declaring the end from the beginning. And from ancient time, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. That destroys open theism. Whatever this risk-taking God is, this God with a... And there's some kind of like song, Tony, some kind of contemporary song, talks about God's reckless love.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I hate that song. Yeah.
Right. The whole idea is God's taking a risk, throwing all caution to the wind. And the problem is, if God's taking risks, that leaves us floating out in the wind, as we have said. And if we're floating out of the wind and God's taking risk, you know what I'm not doing?
Right. Yeah.
I'm not taking risks.
Right. Yeah.
It's too chancy.
You're right. It's too risky. Yeah.
Might be somebody else to take your better chances with. Who knows? Mm-hmm. I mean, and of course, that's blasphemy and that's heresy. But one of the things we do want to talk about today, Tony, is godly risk taking.
Mm-hmm.
And not God taking risk, but godly risk taking, which is for us. And the only reason that we can take godly risks is not because God takes risks, but because God never takes risks.
Mm-hmm.
And so our future is absolutely secure if we trust him. There's this John Piper quote I was going to say for later, but it just seems to go well here. So God never takes risks, but he also talks about how Christ has given us eternal life. And so he's removed the eternal risk from us. He says, by removing eternal risk, Christ calls his people to continual temporal risk. When the threat of death becomes a door to paradise, the final barrier to temporal risk is broken. When a Christian says from the heart to live as Christ and to die as gain, he's free to live for Christ no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Good quote.
Right. So we can take godly risks because God doesn't take risks. Now, there's some examples of godly risk-taking in the Scripture. You remember in 1 Samuel, Jonathan, when he went and took his armor bearer, and the Philistines were there, and it was just Jonathan and his armor bearer. You remember that story?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Jonathan says to the young man carrying his armor. He says, "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." And then what do they do? They go out, just him and his armor bearer, and they defeat the Philistines because they trusted God, that God knew and held the future in his hands. Another example of godly risk-taking that comes to mind is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Yeah, very much so.
So you remember their story, the idol that they were supposed to fall down and worship?
Mm-hmm.
And quite a risk from human speaking to not bow down, because you're going to the option seems to be you're just going to be burnt to a crisp in a furnace.
Yeah.
Right?
Right, yeah.
And they don't bow down. They refuse to bow down. And then they're brought before King Nebuchadnezzar. And he's like, why are you not bowing down? And one of the things I love about their risk-taking, their godly risk-taking, is they tell Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer. We don't answer to you, Nebuchadnezzar. Mm-hmm. But they say,
if it could have been done right then and there, yeah.
It could have been over. That was a pretty calculated risk. But if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we're not going to serve your God, your gods, or worship the golden image that you have set up. So here's what you have in this, is the very elements of risk, right? They don't know the future. They trust God, but remember, God's not a genie or a robot lever that we pull or somebody we can control, right? God's promises are for us, but it does not, just like you remember when Satan tempted Jesus to jump off the temple edge because God promises to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're not to presume on God's protection in that type of way. So they take a risk. The risk is we don't know what God is going to do here, but we do know where God has told us to go. And so we don't know the future. This is going to take faith, and they don't bow down. And then they were killed in the fiery furnace, right?
No, they were not.
No. Okay. No, God protected them.
I do like when they, like, you're talking about the different things that they said, and all being quite risky, actually. But I love the boldness of them, the unwavering faith of them saying that, you know, God can save us, but even if he doesn't, you know, we're still going to do the right thing. And yeah, that was always one of my favorites growing up.
So here's a question for you, Tony. When was the last time you took a risk?
When was the last time I took a risk? I mean, we counting out things at work?
Yeah, that'll work.
No, I'm saying,
no pun intended that time.
Well, no, I'm saying, are we not counting out things that worked, but things at my work?
That's what I meant. Times at your work. That'll work.
In that case, just the other week, I shared the gospel with a high school student. For my job, I happened to be at a school that day, and happened to have a good conversation.
You took a risk sharing the gospel where you work, and some people might be thinking, well, you know, that's not much of a risk. Or other people are thinking, oh man, that really is a risk to share the gospel. But then when you add the fact that this is your job, this is a school, it is a risk into it. And you don't know how the person's going to respond, and you don't know what God's going to do there. So you have to take the opportunity in front of you. And Tony, I think most of us probably take risks all the time. Not as important as the one you've taken here. Most of us take pointless and stupid risks, right? People waste their money. Now, hopefully none of our listeners do this, but every time I'm at the the convenience store, somebody's taking a risk on a lottery ticket. All kinds of ways. You know, the way we drive is a risk that many people take. It amazes me sometimes, Tony, when you're on the interstate and you're driving already the speed limit, or maybe even over the speed limit, and you're trying to pass somebody on the left, and there's somebody that comes flying up behind you. Have you ever, like just the other day, somebody did that. There was a semi truck on my right. I'm passing a semi truck. This guy comes flying me up behind me. He goes into the right lane and then goes over into the side and flies around the semi truck, off-roading it on the interstate.
Yeah, I've seen that. Sometimes I have to drive, I have to drive quite a distance for work. So I'm always on some highway or another. And I see that all the time when it's even really bad weather, like lots of rain or real icy. And yeah, there's just people that just blow by you going, you know, 90 or whatever. And that's stupid risk.
Stupid risk, not worth the reward. So we don't mind taking risks, even risks that cause us physical harm. But what about risks that might cause our death? You don't want to die just simply seeking a thrill. Not if you're a godly man. You want your death to be worth something. So here's a question for our listeners. When was the last time you took a risk? Right? Maybe you're the young guy, and there's that girl at your church. When was the last time you asked the girl out on a date? Right? You know you want to get married. You're always thinking, man, I want to get married. And there's this girl I like, but you're too afraid to go ask, or to go ask her father. Right? You're too afraid of getting your feelings hurt. This next question we had previously beforehand. Some of this stuff has come from us. From Stephen Baker, and he wrote this question, have you risked spoiling a relationship with your office mate by sharing the gospel with them? Are you more interested in your comfort than their salvation? Mm-hmm. Have you ever had like a big dream or are you too afraid to fall on your face? You know, maybe you're in a job that you absolutely hate, and you know, there's no movement up on this place. There's nowhere you can go from here, but you're just afraid to take a chance somewhere else.
Yep. I'll speak from personal experience. I've been there and done that. That's a stupid thing to do, is stay at a job that, is terrible. I mean, for multiple reasons. I stayed at one for years, and, even my own wife was, you need to get another job. You need to get out of this place. There's nowhere to go. It's a terrible place. They treat everybody terrible. And yeah.
Now listen, Tony, the risk sometimes for some people, maybe actually staying in that job.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And I think because,
but not for you. I think you were wise to get out of there when you got out of there.
A lot more backstory to that one that we're not going to go into right now.
But for some people that don't ever stick out a job for every, you know, they're jumping job to job. And that's a lot of young men.
Yep.
I mean, it was me when I was younger. The risk was actually staying at a place where I would have to submit to other people.
Right.
So, but there are godly risks. And the thing is, if you don't try, then you'll never fail.
I think that is kind of failure, though.
Exactly. Martin Lloyd Jones said, if you do not attempt anything, you will succeed every time.
It's not much of success, but yeah, that's true.
You'll succeed at not attempting anything.
Succeed in failure, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. So godly risk taking. Now, we got more to say about this and some practical things to it, but I think it'd be good to go to our interview now and discuss with a young man who's taken some risks, even in just the nature of how him and his wife are going to live, the house that they built, and the job that he does.
We're going to take a break. We come back, we're going to be on the line with Jordan Goodwin, a man who is well-versed with quite a few risks and some that not a lot of us have taken. So stick around. You are listening to The Patriarchy on the Fight Laugh Feast Network. We'll be right back. Do you think that feminism is a raging dumpster fire that ruins little girls and women? Yeah, so do we. Do you think that little boys are not defective girls, and that they should run around, act crazy, get dirty, and play with toy guns? Yeah, so do we. Do you think that if some guy named Daniel chops off his manhood, puts on a dress, some lipstick, and calls himself Deborah, that he's still a guy, albeit pretty messed up? Yeah, we agree. So if you're a man and you're not ashamed of it, go to confessionalware.com, click on podcast collaborations, and look for the Patriarchy Podcast. Go grab yourself a t-shirt or two, maybe a coffee mug. Go to confessionalware.com, click on podcast collaborations, and look for the Patriarchy Podcast. Go grab yourself something nice and trigger a feminist today. On the line with Jordan Goodwin. Jordan was raised in Middle Tennessee. He is a full-time blacksmith. He's built his own home, and he's married to his wife of almost 7 years, Atlanta, and together they have 4 children with 2 on the way. Jordan, welcome to the Patriarchy.
Thanks for having me.
Jordan, we're glad to have you. You know, from time to time we try to highlight young men who are busy being working hard and working with their hands and things like that. You're pretty young to be in the Patriarchy. So my question is for you, Jordan, first off, is shouldn't you be doing like all the other millennials and cross-dressing and eating some Tide Pods, whatever they're called?
I know lots of fine millennials, I'll just say. Or I've never understood, is millennial just an age range, or does it go further than that?
Technically, I think it's an age range on paper. Yeah.
Might be a mindset.
I think to all of us, it's taken on more of the mindset.
Meaning
as well. But anyway, so I'm in the age range, but definitely not the mindset.
All right.
Closest thing I get to Tide Pods is beef jerky. So.
Hey, there you go.
All right. Well, Jordan, we did want to bring you on and talk about how you became a blacksmith. And so why don't you kind of tell us about how you were raised and kind of what got you interested in a trade like blacksmithing?
So I was raised on a hobby farm, you might say. Lots and lots of things going on and growing, but never a lot of money being made. So more of a hobby farm. My dad has worked a full-time corporate job most of my life, and since I was very little. But he was a bit of a history nut, and when I was very young, he introduced us to the Disney Davy Crockett movies that he loved as a kid, and back when Disney made things that were at least somewhat manly.
You're right.
And that pretty much started it all. I spent many years between the ages of 6 and 13 or 14 wearing a coonskin cap everywhere. Became a real history nut, and then later in my teenage years got into Civil War reenacting and things like that. And anyway, so I've always had a love for history and everything old. And I knew I wanted to farm by the time I was 12 or 13. I knew I wanted to have a homestead, and I wanted it to be old-fashioned, and I wanted to do things more old-fashioned than a lot of people. And it was kind of that line of thinking that persisted that drew me to my future wife when I was 18. And she had many of the same aspirations. So I always knew I wanted to get into blacksmithing because I wanted to be able to make my own tools and hardware for the farm. And I had no idea how difficult it would be to learn, but I always grew up busy with my hands, sewing buckskin clothes for myself at a young age and trying my hand at making knives and all kinds of stuff like that. But I didn't get to try blacksmithing until I was 18 and building my house and wanted to start making hardware. And then didn't really do much with it for a while. But then about 3 years ago, I built a small shop, set up my tools, and started making a few random small items to sell, which forced me to get into the shop and get practice and start learning the trade. And about a year ago, I decided that the blacksmithing business had grown to the point where I couldn't juggle it and our other full-time home business, which was a fabrication business, of all things, making miniature beds. And I decided I liked blacksmithing a whole lot more than welding and fabrication. So then I could decide that. I knew that already. But when it got to be too much to do both, then we went full time with the blacksmithing and quit everything else. So it's been a wild ride.
Nice.
Jordan, you built your own home, right?
Yeah, when I started courting my wife when I was 18, I already had interest in building a log home. I was already thinking about it, been inspired by a friend. And so when it was becoming apparent that marriage was on the horizon, even before we were engaged, I started work on the house. Cut all the logs off of the family farm, with the exception of a few I bought off the next door neighbor. And my dad, when I was very little, before he took the corporate job, made a living with a small sawmill. So we've always had the sawmill, and I just got to say, I'm doing a very patriarchal thing right now. My wife just brought me a jar that needed opening. And gave it to it, but I'm not done. Anyway, so yeah, I cut all the trees down and milled them up square on the sawmill, and with the help of friends and family, got the house stacked up. It took me about 9 months to get all the material cut out, and then we had 3 months left before the wedding to make it livable, go from bare dirt to somewhat of a livable structure. My father-in-law said he'd prefer four walls and a roof, and I asked him when he came for the wedding if he thought this would do, and he said, well, he guessed it'd have to. When we moved in, we had no running water, no indoor toilet, and very little electricity. Oh, and wow. you could see the dirt under the house through the cracks in the subfloor. And the wind whistled through the unfinished second story. We were basically doing all of our living in one room. So,
but you built it then. You built it with your own hands. You said earlier you used your teeth.
Yeah. I'm sure I did for something at some point. But I had plenty of power tools along the way and hand tools as well. And that's actually, I don't know if this is related to what y'all want to talk about, but it's actually something that, I like to talk about is, you know, as someone who's homeschooled from day one, I have a lot to be thankful for. And my wife was too. We have a lot that we're thankful for with our parents, you know, taking those first steps, towards, you know, trying to live more biblically as Christians and thinking outside of the box and, you know, questioning the way things are usually done in our sad society. And, but one of the other ways that I've been able to stand on the shoulders of my father is, he raised me to work alongside him and work the land alongside him and view the land as something good to steward. And that's a whole other topic for another day, his thoughts on sustainable forestry and stuff that I've taken up. But anyway, and so when it came time for me to build a house, I was able to acquire land from him. I had the use of his equipment and timber, and I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have built a house from scratch without all of those resources that I already had at my disposal. You know, and of course we had to work out between us, you know, all of those details and what that would look like and all of that. But, you know, my dad really, in a lot of ways, you know, already had an inheritance laid up for his grandchildren in all of that.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
And of course, you know, in all of this, I'm not holding, you know, as much as I honor my father in all this, I'm not holding him or me or us or our family or our farm up as a great example of anything. Like, do not get the idea that it's, you know, some perfect utopia or anything. But there are good things that, you know, that where the grace of God is evident in our lives, some major things that we have to be thankful for.
So I got a question. When you were going to build your house, did you have any people that were adverse to that risk? Whether it be friends or neighbors or anybody that was just like, man, you're crazy for building your own house.
Yeah, I don't know. Most of it, it's not, we live in a really unique area.
Okay.
With a lot of weirdos, a lot of back to the land people, a lot of Amish, Mennonites, hippies, you name it. And, so building your own house wasn't so much of that wasn't really crazy in my circles. Building in log was.
Oh, okay.
And I came under a lot of fire for wanting to build a fairly decent sized, I mean, it's not huge, it's like 1500 square feet, a fairly decent sized house that was permanent.
Okay.
And some of that was well deserved. I mean, I had, you know, I had pressure from relatives and relatives to be to not do something temporary, but I got a lot of advice, and not all of it was bad from people that I knew, encouraging me to build small and temporary, for something, you know, for us to live in for the first few years. And, you know, the options were build, you know, bigger and permanent and it not be very finished, or, you know, the advice I was getting was build small and temporary, but more finished and more livable. And that wasn't bad advice. But like I said, there were other factors in the situation and other advice that had to be heeded a little closer.
What did your bride to be, your now wife, what did she think about that?
She was very vocal in not wanting a temporary situation. She lived on leased and rented ranches her entire life, and she really wanted something more permanent. So here we are, and this is, you know, I'm not blaming anybody else, but here we are working on 7 years later, and we still live in an unfinished house. But there's no major debt attached to it, no payments, and it's pretty cozy.
So at any point along the way, did the risk you were taking, did that get to you? Did you ever have a moment where you're like, what am I doing? And how did you deal with that? How did you come back out of that?
I have those thoughts occasionally, all the time, and always have, but they've never been a real significant problem for me. I guess my dad is such a contrarian, and I was raised, like I said, homeschooled and all of that in a very kind of contrarian environment. And I came out quite contrary. And so I've never been one to really, really, really feel the pressure to do things the normal way. But like I said, it does get to you every once in a while. But yeah, I mean, I've always felt the risk of, you know, being self-employed, being without the typical insurance and benefits that come from a corporate job and all of that. But, you know, my wife-to-be, you know, we decided long before we married that that we wanted to both live at home and work at home. Not just her, myself as well. I wanted to be home for my children and any children that I would be blessed with, not to mention her, especially bringing her 900 miles away from anything and anybody she'd ever known. You know, a 9-to-5 away from home just wasn't going to cut it. So we decided early on that, you know, the risks and benefits were worth it. And God's been faithful to provide for us in that and done nothing but confirm and strengthen those convictions as time goes along.
So Jordan, the we've talked here, the theme of this episode, what we've been covering is the idea of taking godly risks. And you've set a good example here of you're kind of living out of the box of normal for many people, yet you got your home business that you're working on, you're doing blacksmithing, you built your home. What are some of let's get behind the stuff that you're doing to more like the principles of the risk that you're willing to take to do these things. What kind of guides you in that?
Yeah. So the subject of godly risk taking is a little difficult for me to handle because of the way I tend to look at things. And I guess what I mean by that is while we all, and I'm no exception, have to weigh risks when we're making decisions, I have always just started with principles and run with them, regardless of the consequences, if that makes any sense. Now, like I said, I still weigh risks, but I don't tend to think of myself as a risk taker. I tend to think of myself as, you know, I look at a principle that I believe in, and if I believe in it and believe it to be scriptural, then I don't really have a choice. So while there are real risks, I don't really look at them as risks. I look at them as just necessary and potential consequences. I don't know if that makes any sense, but like I said, I just have a hard time wrapping my head around the risk aspect of it. Because I see things more as duty than risk, if that makes any sense. Damn the torpedoes and full speed ahead. to quote a Yankee, you know? So.
Well, what kind of practical advice that you have, maybe for some of the men listening, you know, whether they're going to build their own home with their teeth or they're going to, you know, be a blacksmith or not, whether they're just building up their home with their families and their wives.
Yeah.
And you painted it very clearly. What's guiding you in this risk stuff is not focusing on the actual risk aspect, but it's the principle on faith. But what practical advice on that do you give our listeners?
And here's where we do get into risk evaluation. This is helping me articulate it maybe a little better. My practical advice to anybody, whether they're starting out, and boy, do I have a lot to say to 14 and 18 year old me, as I'm sure we all do.
Yeah.
But my practical advice to anybody, whether they're starting out or they're anywhere along the road, is ask yourself, what are you risking with your lifestyle? And, you know, because I asked myself starting out, was it worth risking the potential relationships I could have with my family, with my children and my wife, by taking a 9-to-5, you know, job with anybody else, mm-hmm. and being away from my family for the majority of my time. And that, those risks to me, and, you know, and I'd seen that in, you know, most families around me and my own family. I mean, my dad's worked a corporate job for the last 25 years. And I could see clearly both the risks of that sort of lifestyle and the potential of something different, where the father is present with his family all day long, every day. And, you know, it was scary, but the choice is pretty clear. And all along the way, you know, my choices in vocation and business and just all of that have been shaped by that. And I like to put it this way. This is the way I put it to most people. Most people let their work dictate what their lifestyle will be. And while I'm not immune to that in any stretch, I mean, I still have to work and I still have customers to answer to and all of that. My fiance and I decided to make our lifestyle, the lifestyle that we wanted, you know, as we saw a God honoring lifestyle would be, dictate what work would look like, what making a living would look like. Mm. So, you know, we were asking ourselves, you know, how can we, what can we do to provide the absolute most biblically healthy home environment possible? And self-employment was just right there at the top of the list. And yeah, there's huge risks involved, but, you know, there's so much wisdom and proverbs to apply here. And, you know, one of the most hopeful and the most convicting for me is just that diligence is rewarded. Mm-hmm. Period.
Well, man, I think you have given our listeners quite a bit to think about. So If they wanted to get in contact with you at all, can you let them know how they could do that?
Yeah. Probably the easiest, if you're on social media, and you probably are to some extent if you're listening to the podcast, is you can hit me up on Facebook. Hopefully before I max out my friends list and have to start deleting. Or hit me up on Instagram. Instagram has been one of my biggest outlets for marketing. Mm-hmm. And it's probably where I spend the majority of my time with social media and stuff, and it's a good way to get a hold of me. Or there's always email. You can go to my website, axeandanvil.com, and contact me through there, and I see all those emails, and I will respond. So,
well, great. Well, Jordan, thanks for coming on, and I think you've given all of us a lot to think about, and it's good words, man. Thanks for coming on.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate y'all's time, and it was fun.
That was Jordan Goodwin. You are listening to The Patriarchy on the Fight Laugh Feast Network. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I don't know about you, man, but I was encouraged by that. I thought that was, being a young man, he had a lot of wisdom there.
I'm encouraged for the younger men who are able to make some decisions now and take some risks now that that'll pay off long term. The longer you wait to take good risks, it's actually quite risky. to not take good risks when you're young, then you're stuck when you're older. So what are some keys though for risk taking? And what's the difference between godly risk taking and just, you know, kind of throwing all caution to the wind, just taking a shot in the wind, right?
There's godly risk taking, and then there's just recklessness.
Yes, that's the word I'm looking for. Thank you. So what's the difference? Well, I've got five key points here that I think are helpful and help you guide you in your risk taking. So number one, know your map. Know your map. You need a godly plan. You need a good roadmap of where you're going, even if you don't exactly know all the details. So today, in like a map, probably some of our listeners are like, "What's a map? I just know about Google."
Yeah.
Right. I got the GPS, but like a map, you would open up and it might be outdated. It might be like, you're not getting the detailed directions of every step, how many miles in each thing. Mm-hmm. When you're just following the map, you've got the kind of the broad scope of it, but you need to make sure you got a map and you need to have the right map. Suppose, Tony, you wanted to arrive at a specific location in Indiana. And there was a street map, which would be great help in reaching, you know, you're wanting to get to southern Indiana where I'm at.
What's an Indiana that I would want to go to?
You would want to come see me.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. So, but you got the map. The map says southern Indiana, but there was this printing error, and actually it's a map of Detroit.
Oh wow. Yeah.
can you imagine like being frustrated, the ineffectiveness of trying to reach your destination?
I would imagine you'd be way off course, and not to mention that you'd be in Detroit. So,
yeah, you can be taken. You can really, you can try a lot harder with that map. You can be really diligent with that map. You can double your speed. You can make really good risks with that map. But the problem is you're getting to the wrong place just faster. And so godly risk taping needs to have God's map. You need to have God's purposes lined out. You need to go back and listen to the episode on godly ambition, really. If you're driving with the wrong map, it's like you're driving with a map of Detroit, and no one wants to go to Detroit.
Sorry for any of our listeners that are in Detroit, but you should get out of Detroit. Go to Southern Indiana. It's a good place.
They just don't wring my neck when you get here. Okay. Number two. So you have the godly map. You know where you're going. You've got a game plan. So you're not just shooting in the wind. Next thing, and really this thing can happen simultaneously, and maybe even before you're looking for a large risk, is that you're practicing in private. There's this this book, I can't remember who said it, but he said private victories precede public victories. And I thought that was very helpful, right? Risk-taking needs to be in connection with a life connected to Christ, not only in public, but in private. So somebody who's only worshiping God on Sundays, they're only going through the motions, they don't have the faith in Christ to take a stand, right? When if you're not daily invested with Christ and you're practicing reliance on him in the day-to-day things, how in the world are you going to trust him to the big risks? And so you need to practice in the small ways, right? One good small way of practicing is tithing, right? That's money out of your paycheck that you're giving to God. Now, I'm not saying it like a televangelist, like give your seed and then God will double it and have to give you a private jet, or give me a private jet for you giving me the seed.
Exactly. That's more like it. Yeah.
But tithing does show a reliance and a trust on God with your finances. And are you going to do that? Are you going to trust him in difficult, small, in little small ways? And then when it comes to the big issues, you'll be able to take the risks. Third point is being proactive. Being proactive. So this is helpful anywhere, but in particular in taking risks, in that so many of us, we let circumstances and the things happening around us come at us, and they kind of, we're basically just reacting to everything around us, reacting to what other people are doing, reacting to circumstances, and we're always reacting. And our response then is always conditioned on what is happening to us. But to be able to be ready for godly risk-taking, you need to be proactive. You think of the word, even the word responsibility. If you break that down, it's helpful to break that down into two words, responsibility, like your ability to respond. And if you're always reacting, you don't have a lot of responsibility in that sense. But proactive person sees circumstances, see what's happening, and yet they are making decisions not in response necessarily, but they are responding, but they are responding in a positive, where do we go from here kind of attitude, rather than, oh man, this stuff's happening to me, I don't know what I'm doing, you know. Our victimhood mentality in our culture is reactionary. Everything's reactionary. But a godly risk taker is able to be proactive. This is the circumstances I'm in. How do I get to a better place? Or how do I go to somewhere where God would want me better at? And then the last, two more points, but the last more lengthy one is that you look before you leap. And it's kind of similar to the first point. You're not just blindly leaping. Good risk-taking is not erratic. It isn't risk-taking that hasn't done its work. So you've got the map. You know where God wants you to go. And now you're studying the situation. You've already been trusting him on small things. Now you're being proactive. And you're remembering Jesus' words about building a house. No man builds a house without counting the cost. Right? Now you're getting control of the situation. Where are the things that God wants me to go to that maybe I need to start sharing the gospel with people at my work? And so you're getting the lay of the land, right? You're weighing the when's the appropriate time? When's the right time for this? And so you're trying to get all the information. But here's the thing. You're looking before your leap, but then the very next point here, the fifth thing is you have to leap, right? You can't be allowed the paralysis of analysis. That is, you can't be paralyzed by fear. You've seen all the different choices. You know which direction God wants you to take. or at least the general direction, and then you just take the leap, trusting that God controls the outcome. I'm going to give you an example in my life, and then I'll shut up, Tony, okay? A few years back, I had, about 5 years ago, graduated from seminary, was trying to figure out what to do, and there were a couple options. And so a lot of times risk-taking can come when there's lots of options, like which one do I take? We're always wanting some clue, like, you know, God, just make it very clear for which path I'm supposed to take. And you got three or four good options. And I can remember being in like middle school, and I had a couple decisions to make. And I remember being at church and just praying, God, if it's this decision, let that picture fall off the wall. And it was silly stuff like that. Okay. So, but sometimes you're confronted with a situation, you got several decisions you got to make, and which one do you make? How do you know where you go? Well, you've waited out, and so this is the thing. I've at that course. I have an offer to be a school teacher or lead a Christian school, a schoolhouse in Bloomington, with where Tim Bailey's church at, and to be a part of that. And I really wanted to be a part of that. And then there was an opportunity to plant a church here in Southern Indiana, and I was feeling God's call on that, and those were both very good options. Being connected to the church there in Bloomington would have been great. Our family was coming through some bad church experiences, and maybe this would have been just some soothing time for us. But we knew that God was faithful, and we ultimately knew that God had a call in my life to be a pastor. And so whatever decision we did make, that would be the end goal. But so I had to make this decision, and I had some practice in risk-taking. My father had quit his job when he was like 40 and went back to school and on the same day and became a pastor in the same day. It was a great example of taking faith and going where God knew. Same thing. I had taken a leap of faith to go to the seminary that I had gone to. We got to the seminary without any kind of jobs and money to pay for it, but we knew God wanted us there. And God had provided enough to get us to there. And so we were taking a leap of faith. And when we got to the seminary, we got the jobs and that we'd already been working for, and God provided. And if God always provides when you're seeking to follow him. So I sought out the information, tried to be proactive. I probably could have done better. Looked at all the options. And you know what? They were both good. And you're always beating yourself up like, what do I do? If I take the wrong one, you know, am I going to be destroyed and all that kind of thing? And you know what you do? You just take a leap of faith in the one that your heart desires on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what we did. We took a leap of faith, the church planning. Even if I had done that and no church would have materialized out of it, it completely failed. You know what? God was going to provide for me and my family. Mm-hmm. And he has. And man, I have been trusting him the whole way. Now, our church, we're still in the progress of growing, but we have grown. And God has provided for me and my family in amazing ways. And not that I'm the perfect example of risk-taking, godly risk-taking, but I do want just to let our listeners know, man, if you're faithful to just trust God and try to attempt good things for God, where he's called you, God provides.
That he does. He has continued to provide for this show, for the both of us and for the network. And we wanted to take a minute again to thank those of you that have signed up to become Fight Lefties Club members using our code to support us. You are taking a godly risk on us. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that Gabe and Knox and Toby took a godly risk on two guys that we're going to start a podcast about biblical masculinity, and had this shrieking feminist intro idea. And they took a risk on us. And we continue to appreciate that. And we appreciate the members and the support that you guys show us every month. If you'd like to be part of that and you believe in this show and you want to take a godly risk on us, go to fightleftfeast.com, click to sign up to become a member, and use the code PATRIARCHY when you do. It goes to support our show, and it goes back into the network. to help us continue to grow and make better content. Speaking of growing, if you did not know, the Fight Laugh Feast Network now has an app. So you can get that on the Android App Store. You can get it on the Apple App Store. It's also available on Roku and Amazon Fire. You can actually even get it on your Apple TV as well. So go to one of those app stores and search for Fight Laugh Feast Network. Download the app. You can sort through the shows. If you are already a club member, it actually has a portal for that as well, so you can sign in there. It has links to blogs, and there's more to come. So go check that out. Go search for Fight Laugh Feast Network in your app store. So until next time, if you have not yet bowed your knee to Christ, repent and believe. And if you have, this is our call to you. Build, fight, protect, lead. This is The Patriarchy.